Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, no, it's the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Oh, the car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered, like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches, but there aren't, right?
Right, because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at carvana.com.
The gender pay gap begets the gender savings gap, which means we don't invest, which means in my world of raising venture capital and private equity to back my businesses, the single reason for my business success is that I'm really good at asking men for money. Otherwise, I wouldn't have had a career.
This is the Women's Prize for Fiction Bookshelfy podcast, supported by Baileys. Join us in celebrating women's writing from around the world in the 30th anniversary year of the Women's Prize for Fiction, sharing our creativity, our voices, and our perspectives. I'm Vic Hope, and I am your host for Season 8 of Bookshelfy, the podcast that asks inspiring and brilliant women to share the five books by women that have shaped them and their lives. Join me and my incredible guests as we talk about the books you should be adding to your reading list. Today, I am joined by Debbie Wasko, OBE. Debbie is a multi-exit entrepreneur, investor, and one of the UK's most influential business figures. Best known for founding the home swapping platform Love Home Swap and co-founding the women's network Allbright, she's built and scaled multiple successful businesses, advised the UK government on the sharing economy, and now co-chairs the Invest in Women Task Force, driving hundreds of millions of pounds of investment into female-led companies. A former board member at the Women's Prize Trust, Debbie is executive chair of the Better Menopause, a company that produces science-backed nutritional supplements for women navigating perimenopause and menopause. A board member of the Mayor of London's Business Advisory Board and a non-executive director at Channel 4. She's also the co-author of the business bestseller, Believe, Build, Become, How to Supercharge Your Career. She was awarded an OBE in June 2016 for services to business and received Freedom of the City of London in 2019. Debbie.
That was so excruciating.
Sorry, I realised you just had to sit through that. You're just looking at me like,
that's the full wiki. Okay.
How does it feel hearing all of that back?
A bit embarrassing.
Really?
Yeah, a bit tired.
You know what?
Yeah.
It's incredible, though.
Thank you. Thanks, Vic.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We have talked books a few times. We've sat over dinner and discussed.
Mostly in nightclubs.
I wasn't going to say. But we've seen each other in nightclubs a few times. But it's so lovely to get to sit down and discuss the books that you feel have shaped. You have read so widely. Mm. How difficult was it to choose five?
It was impossible.
Yeah.
So books have always been my happy place and my solace. I was a very nerdy, bookish child, and I think although, as per my sort of wiki intro, I'm known for being a businesswoman, actually reading and theatre, but reading for the purpose of this conversation, is where I like to spend my time. So I probably do get through, I don't know, like 40 or 50 books a year. I'm quite a big reader and I'm not a big sleeper. So reading for me is something that happens a lot.
Having all night.
Yeah, it happens every night, but it happens on holidays definitely with focus. And I found this impossible. And I think I thought hard because I'd done 7 years as a trustee of the Women's Prize. And because the red thread through my career is women, what can I possibly add to this conversation? You know, we were discussing, you've been presenting the podcast for the last 4 years, I think, three, four years.
Time flies, yes.
And I did in a very sort of business analytical way, look at the recommendations that incredible women had made around incredible female authors and incredible books. And I felt like I wanted to do something a bit different. So I have avoided the canon. So in my choice of five, read into it, of course, Jane Austen and Charlotte Bronte and Anne of Green Gables and Nora Ephron and Barbara Kingsolver and Hilary Mantel, of course. We must all.
Caveat
it. Right, caveat. Yeah. But what I tried to do focus-wise was think about the last decade of my life. Think about some of the books that I've come across that perhaps not everybody's read. So hopefully for people listening to this, there are a few tips of things that I have loved. And I suppose think about the things that get me out of bed in the morning. And a lot of that is around women and sisterhood and real life sisters and friendship. And it was only when I started to try and do the list of five that I realised that that was a common thread between a lot of the things that I really loved and that stayed with me. So I hope that for listeners, there are a few that might be new. It brings me a bit more up to date in terms of my reading, and it leaves us all reflecting on what has been the joy of being part of the prize for me in the last 7 years, which is the power of the female view and the female word.
There's been a few times we've had guests on the podcast who said, you know what, when I started to pick these books, I realised something about myself that I hadn't realised before, and I'm seeing these common threads and what I'm drawn to, and it hadn't really clicked, but there it is.
I felt like that. Some of the books are quite dark, I think.
What does that say?
Well, quite, maybe. But also, I think there's real... There can be beauty in pain, I suppose. What is it that I realised as I picked them that actually, this is a Hilary Mantel, I suppose, even though we're not doing her, but I'll do her quickly. You know, I like passages and books I've got a good memory that I can remember that mean something to me. And actually the Wolf Hall line around the things you think are disasters in your life are not disasters, really. Almost anything can be turned around. Out of every ditch a path, if only you can see it. And that, you know, that I have written like in capital letters on the side of my laptop. And I think that's what I love in fiction. And I have picked five fiction books. I'm a much bigger reader of fiction than nonfiction, although I have written a nonfiction book. Because I love to lose myself in other people's stories, in women's stories, but out of every ditch a path. So some of the books that I've chosen, I think, are beautiful and uplifting and engaging, even though they're dealing with really difficult subject matter, suicide, addiction, difficult family relationships, which touch all of our lives. And I'm 51 now, and life is not straightforward, but out of every ditch a path and finding the light in the shade, I suppose, is my superpower.
You never know when you needed to hear something. I actually really needed to hear that line right then.
Out of every ditch a path.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. And I've had some high highs and some really low lows, particularly over the last sort of 17 years since I became a mother. And there is a theme in the five of motherhood. Motherhood and being a mother and being mothered and how we mother and how we decide how to mother, which is very imperfect, and how we learn through motherhood is something that I'm endlessly interested by because I'm endlessly getting it wrong and getting it right. So I think recognising that really as women, we can determine our own life path, we can determine our own happiness, even when it feels bad, there's light in the shade.
And determining your own life path, having that power, is a constant thread throughout your work and also through the book that you've written. But let's talk about those life moments like you just described and the books that have accompanied you through them. Some of them, some not of all them. Of them.
Yeah, yeah,
not
some all of them. The last decade. Yeah.
Your first book, Shelby book, is All My Puny Sorrows by Miriam Taves. All My Puny Sorrows offers a profound reflection on the limits of love and the sometimes unimaginable challenges we experience when childhood becomes a new country of adult commitments and responsibilities. In this powerful novel, Taves gives us a startling demonstration of how to carry on with hope and love and the business of living, even when grief loads the heart. Tell us about why you chose this
book. I just love her. And I was late to her because I think All My Puny Sorrows is 2014 and I don't think I read it until about 2023 or 2022, and I first read Fight Night,
right,
which is also a brilliant book.
And did that bring you to Taves?
It did, right. Yeah. You know, what is at the heart of this? And Fight Night is about a really moving mother-daughter-granddaughter relationship. This is about sisters. And I have sisters. I have a lot of sisters. You know, and I always talk about in my book and as I reflect on my work around economic empowerment for women, that I'm the latest in a long line of proudly difficult women. And my sisters stand alongside me in this regard. And this is about two sisters, the Von Riesen sisters, and the novel's narrator has always lived in her sister's shadow, and her sister is gifted and beautiful and happily married, and she's a very celebrated concert pianist. However, Yolandi, the other sister, feels like a failure, but Elfriede, the sort of super talented kick-ass sister, has really, really challenging mental health issues, and she is depressed. And the novel is about her wanting to kill herself, which sounds like a sort of horrible read or a devastating break in a relationship between sisters. But I actually found it unbelievably uplifting and beautiful. You know, there's a quote from it where, and it's very funny. You know, Landy says, she wanted to die and I wanted her to live. And so we were enemies who loved each other, you know, which is just a sort of shard to the heart. So, for me as well, for the author, because when I read something that I love, I try to dig deep on the author. She is drawing on the suicide of her own sister, so it is a real life story. And I don't know if you've seen the, you know, again, I draw a lot of comparisons between books and theatre. But if you've just seen, I saw Minnie Driver and I saw Lenny Henry in the play recently, which also has a suicide theme to it. Which is about, you know, brilliant things in life. And I think there's a lot to draw from these very dark tales. I found it honest and funny and gut-wrenching. And I think as a writer, she mixes laughter and poignancy like no one else. So I would say it's a must-read. And she's not terribly well-known in the UK. And I would say read everything she's written.
When you say gut-wrenching, honest and funny, which of those emotions do you think lingered with you the longest?
I think gut-wrenching. I think it always does, doesn't it? I think these dark stories of how beautiful and challenging life can be. And I think we've all have people in our lives who struggle with their mental health, you know. A line from the play that I, the Minnie Driver play that I saw on Saturday, which is that anybody who hasn't struggled with their mental health over the years just hasn't been living properly. I think that in extremis, which is what happens in this book and how it impacts on sisters, and depending on how you count them, I've got four sisters, so I've steps and halves and all that. And I think also that dynamic of sisterly love and understanding and fractiousness and everything that comes with sisterhood for me is super powerful.
And, you know, for those of us who don't have sisters by blood, sisterhood extends beyond to, you know, our sisters around the world, our sisters who are our friends. The book explores the limits and the challenges of helping someone you love, whoever that might be. How's that theme inform the way that you lead teams of our sisters who support others under pressure? Have you implemented anything that you feel like you learned from the book?
Well, you know, I think Albright, which was my third business, which were the members clubs for women and the digital platform for women's careers, you know, our mantra, if you like, was Sisterhood Works, which we had written in neon in the entrance halls of the buildings here and in the US. And the reason that was front and center in how we thought about that business was because we really believed it. Anna, my co-founder, Anna Jones, was one of four sisters as well, both of us the eldest, so read into that what you will. And I knew which you could tell if you met us. And I think that the red thread definitely through the last decade, and that's the period of time when I've hit these books, has been the belief that women's networks are not as strong as men's. Women's work networks get less powerful as we age up. And you know it, Vic, because you're in it right now. But that period of time when you've got tiny children, The last thing anybody wants to do ever, anyway, is go to a networking event where they don't know anyone and there's sort of canapes and warm wine and you walk in on your own as a woman. So a big part of the thesis behind Albright was to create spaces that were by women for women, where everything from the hand wash in the basins to the art on the walls was about showcasing the female experience and female talent. And I think we tried really hard to build supportive environments for women, but that were also challenging. And I suppose that's sort of, when I try and distill that book and what it tells us, is that it isn't always easy to love. It isn't always easy to support. Sometimes the best version of support is saying and doing unpalatable things. But I think that when I look to my own network at 51 and my career network, which has been built now 26 years since I started my first business, it's the women in my life who are there for me, who are there to support me. But that doesn't always mean that they're not sharing some unpalatable truths with me. And I think those are the people that we love forever, don't we?
Yeah, sisterhood.
Sisterhood, yeah.
That idea that it's not always easy to love or be loved is very strong in your second book, Shelfie Book, which is Loved and Missed by Susie Boyd.
Yeah.
When your beloved daughter is lost in the fog of addiction and you make off with her baby in order to save the day, can willpower and a daring creative zeal carry you through? Examining the limits, disappointments and excesses of love in all its forms, Loved and Missed is a whip-smart, incisive and mordantly witty novel about love's gains and missteps. Now, I know that the author, Susie Boyd, is a friend of yours.
She's my friend, so it's a cheat, isn't it?
It's not a cheat. It actually gives it a whole other level. Did knowing the author on a personal level impact how you experienced this book? Did you sort of find an intimacy that brought a new layer of understanding to it?
Yeah, so I would say so. I mean, I've known Susie for probably 15 years, and therefore I've got the privilege of having an insight into her very kind heart. That's how she is as a person. She's loyal, she's sensitive, she's thoughtful. We met when we were on the board of the Hampstead Theatre together, and I've always been a super fan of her writing because she's a beautiful writer, and I think she is, as she is in life, observant and sensitive and a fantastic storyteller in a quiet way, I would say. So if I thought about Loved and Missed, which I think is the best pick of Susie books, but I would direct everybody to read Susie books, it's a quiet masterpiece about women's lives. I think it has that in common with our first book, actually, and it's got a daughter mother granddaughter dynamic. I actually read it, I can't always remember when I read things, but I do remember Loved and Missed, because I read it in a day and into the night when I was in Ibiza, which is both of our happy places. But and I love an early night, so it takes a lot to stay up. So that tells you everything you need to know about Susie's writing. Again, it's happy, sad, funny, tragic. And the thing that I loved about it is it's about the excesses and the limits and the disappointments of love. I read a review of it which called it a thriller about parenting, which I thought was a very accurate description. And as you described, it's about a grandmother, Ruth, raising her granddaughter, Lily, whilst her addict daughter has relinquished parental control. And she rescued, or essentially kidnapped, her as a baby. It's about the heartbreak of addiction, really, and loving someone who can't love you in return. But much like the first book, I didn't find it a sad book. I thought that there was lots that it spoke so beautifully to about the tiny, lovely, quiet moments of child rearing. And Susie's brilliant at that, you know, biscuits dunked in tea and holiday breaststroking in the Balearics. What was the point for me? I am a single mother. I have been since my kids were tiny. You know, the thing that I really ruminated on is that the strands through the mother, daughter, granddaughter, and you have Ruth raising Lily with very, very careful love in the same way she raised Eleanor, who is an addict. Yeah. And this sort of essay existential, I'm awake at night question, which is particularly the case, I think, for the single mother where you tend not to have anyone to talk to about it, is what if our best parenting efforts don't work, or they're useless, or they're not good enough, right? And that for me was the thread through Susie's book, which I think is the dark question that we often then ask ourselves, really writ large. The other thing about Susie's writing is she's brilliant at letting the major show-stopping events happen off screen, if you know what I mean. So that's the way that she often writes. They sort of happen, and then you find out that they've happened in the next chapter. I thought that was just brilliantly deployed in this book, which has drama in it, but it is really a way of using some of the small moments in life to showcase some of the biggest issues. She's just super talented at that.
I love the way you describe those small moments, the dunking of biscuits in tea, or the breaststroke in the Balearics, those little gestures of care. How do you show love?
Oh, God. I mean, I don't show it through cooking. Like, I'm a fantastically undomestic mother, if you ask either of my children, who are generally on the brink of getting scurvy. I think that I, with them, and they're nearly 15 and 17, Noah's 17 next week, you know, we've been a tight team their whole lives, and we do a lot together through experiences, so through travel, and then they're quite different, my kids. So for Noah, our thing is theatre. It's always been theatre. And it's an amazing thing to have a theatre companion who's sort of new to theatre and, frankly, who will sit through a lot of tough stuff. So we tend to do that together. Gracie's mega sporty, and she plays, you know, lacrosse at a very high level, and I watch her play. So honestly, it's imperfect, but my thing for them has always been showing up, and it's always been listening. And what I'm trying to achieve as the mother of teenagers is to sit on the side of, you can tell me anything I would rather know, which is a sort of difficult message to land with them. So I think I show love through conversation and through connection and through doing stuff together. I'm not very good at, like, you know, the joke about me is always the thing that you would never say is I'm just going to sit on the sofa and flop. I'm not very good at that. But I think in the context of loved and missed, it is small things. I can just about stretch to making them a cup of tea, you know, I can. But we tend to be actively doing things together, and we always have.
We've talked about how you know Susie Boy. You've met so many authors throughout your professional life. You've interviewed so many your Albright clubs around the world. And of course, you were on the board for the Women's Prize Trust, which is the charity behind the Women's Prizes. Was it that access to female creatives that drew you to the Women's Prize?
Totally, because I'm a nerd and I'm not creative in that way. Like, I always feel like I've had a book in me, but I've never dared put that to the test, fiction, that is. And I think a wonderful part of my business life and being a founder to create the business that I want to run or the environment that I want to be in every day, for me, is getting to know female creative talent that sits adjacent to my world. So writers, fiction and non-fiction, playwrights, theatre directors, artists, you know, Albright was an amazing backdrop for all of those things, because within reason, we could invite anyone in, and for a period of time they wanted to come, right? And it was a sort of metaphor for all of those things. And that for me is great joy. I'm endlessly curious about how creative people are so talented. And I think adjacency to them, I hope some of that talent sort of rubs off, you know. So yeah, absolutely. And I think for the prize, you know, why the prize? Yes, books and reading and writers. But one of the stats for me that always stuck, and I chaired the development board for the prize, which business people frequently do because you're responsible for sort of shaking the tin to fundraise, is that the gender pay gap in writing and in fiction is bigger than the gender pay gap and anything else, 36%. So I get connected in my charitable work, but kind of in my business world as well, to economic inequality. I just think we need to have those conversations. And if I can use my muscle for anything, it's to drive change. And so I felt that that could be my role with the prize, as well as just sort of nerding off, because I get to meet writers and that's great. And also it's just the best reading list of the year every year, and I read the long list and the short list. I think that showcasing economic inequality. You know, in my world as an entrepreneur, only 2% of venture capital in the UK goes to back a female entrepreneur, and yet we deliver 35% better returns than men. And that has not changed in my entrepreneurial lifetime, and it needs to change. So I tend to be quite simple in the way that I think about things. If I see something like that, I want to showcase the statistics and push for change. And I think the prize has a really important role to play in that, because prize winners exponentially earn more money. And that's a basic thing to say, but I'm kind of basic about this stuff. I don't think women talk about money enough. And I don't think we talk enough about wanting to be rich. We should. Like, we absolutely should. And then we deploy our capital in backing other women. Great. But unless we even have the conversation, then I don't think change happens. So the prize for me was a sort of beautiful circle of all of those things, like nerd adjacency. But, you know, being able to incorporate creativity in my conversations about why do women under-earn men so significantly, the gender pay gap begets the gender savings gap, which means we don't invest, which means in my world of raising venture capital and private equity to back my businesses, the single reason for my business success is that I'm really good at asking men for money. Otherwise, I wouldn't have had a career. And that needs to change. Female investor is twice as likely to back a female entrepreneur as a male investor. So for books, it's not something that we think about. And I've picked one of the prize winners to talk about. But if I were to pick another one, I think Fugitive Pieces, which was a really early winner, is just a brilliant example of the economic clout of the prize. I think I'm going to misquote the stats, but it had sold something like, I don't know, like hundreds of copies before it won the prize. And it went on to sell 25 million copies and have a movie made. And so I think that these things are so important. Kate Moss, of whom I am a super fan, founded the prize 30 years ago, in a year when there were no female authors on the Booker long list. And I think we all have a responsibility to showcase this incredible female talent that's out there and make sure that they can make a living as a creative. It's just increasingly hard to do it, and it's always harder for women.
The track record of the prize is undeniable. It is incredible, and I totally agree with what you say about being around those creatives and it rubbing off. It's inspiring, isn't it? It's uplifting. That's what we do. Well, let's talk about that prize winner now.
Yes.
Your third book is Piranesi by Susanna Clarke. And actually, you mentioned before about going to the theatre with your son, Noah.
Yeah.
I know you both read this book around the same time. And this was a winner in 2021, which was the year that I
judged. You were the judge.
Yes.
Amazing.
Piranesi lives in a dreamlike house with infinite halls, endless corridors and thousands of statues, recording its wonders in his journal. His tranquil existence is disrupted when messages appear hinting at another person's presence and a mysterious truth about his world and identity, forcing him to uncover secrets and confront a reality far different from the one he knows. My God.
I know, that was an amazing description. I don't think I'm not going to attempt it.
It's so strange.
Yeah, it's
and
so strange.
I know that you, like me, read it for 50, 60 pages going, not for me, not for me. And then, bam, we're in.
That's it. I mean, I love, Susanna Clarke is an amazing writer, and I love Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. But there was obviously a huge gap, and she had, you know, loads of health challenges. And this book is not my normal kind of book, right? And similarly, as you described it, the first 60 pages are very geographical, you know, because they're scoping out this labyrinth and the rooms and the birds and the statues and the skeletons. And I'm like, what, you know, like, where are we? And you have to keep going back and rereading it to check
so
you've
much.
Got where you are. But it's so other and so high impact, and it's so magical and mysterious, and it's not my normal book. And I think as I read it, and then because I was doing this with you, I had to kind of quickly reread everything. It's quite hard to talk about books that you read a long time ago. This is 2021. It's a metaphor for the internal world that we all have in our heads. And I think the reason I picked it as my prize winner out of 30s is because I think it shows the breadth of what women can write.
Yes.
Right? It's not a woman's story. It's not a woman's story. It's not relationships. It's not, you know, all the other stuff that I've picked is potentially a bit more in that conventional what we expect women to write. And the part of the reason for picking that is that, again, back to the kind of economics of fiction, men read less than women. Men buy books written by men almost exclusively. Women buy books written by men and women. And that's part of the reason why women are just underread. However, I think this is a book for anyone that happens to be written by a woman. And that's why I wanted to pick it, because I think it's just it just shows the breadth of what women can write, but also of what women can read and appreciate. And for me, it was a good push out of my comfort zone, because when I saw it on the list, and I don't know how it was for you as judges, it was very other compared to anything else that year. And I think picking something that's different and special and magical and melancholy and high impact and happens to be written by a woman, it is a big a sort of win for the prize.
I think we both thought, this is not the kind of book I usually read. And then I sort of thought, I don't think it's the kind of book anyone usually reads.
No, 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 how can it be? Because it's so very different, agreed.
So utterly transporting. Did the experience of sharing the reading with your son?
With Noe.
Yeah,
I love doing that. Yeah, definitely. Because I know he struggled with it at first too. And I generally, he reads what he wants to read. But I do highly recommend Women's Prize winners to him. And the fact that he tends to reread, which I don't do, the fact that he went through this quite a few times, I think, made it clear to me how high impact and different the storytelling was, and just the quality of the writing.
You literally read it as though you're exploring those halls, that geography.
Absolutely.
You keep going back and
absolutely
lost, where am I going now? The novel celebrates curiosity and stillness in such a fast-moving business world.
Yes.
Do you see value in Piranesi's focus on the calm?
Yeah, I mean, I find that practically impossible. I'm terrible at meditation. You know, all the things I'm always told to do for calm, I find difficult. I do, you know, I exercise every day, but I do it pretty relentlessly. I walk, but I do it quickly. The calm for me is reading and theatre. That's my calm place, because I do find it easy to transport myself into somebody else's world with those stimulus. In my actual life, I find it really hard to slow down. So no matter how many courses I try to do at the London Buddhist Centre, it just doesn't ever stick, right? How many calm apps I download and delete, it doesn't. But this, for me, is the place where I genuinely can do it. And in the theatre, where you're phone free, where you're transported to somebody else's life. Actually, what I found really interesting was, I'm doing way more than five books now, but Hamnet and the theatre production of Hamnet, obviously it's being made into a movie, which is a previous prize winner. I think I do feel that the red thread through books of theatre is really important for me, but the power of calm that's driven by somebody else's story and getting out of your head, out of your life, out of the office and out of your to-do list and out of the stress is the most powerful thing for me.
Baileys is proudly supporting the Women's Prize for Fiction by helping showcase incredible writing by remarkable women, celebrating their accomplishments and getting more of their books into the hands of more people. Baileys is the perfect adult treat, whether shaken in a cocktail, over ice cream, or paired with your favourite book. Check out baileys.com for our favourite Baileys recipes.
Well, from a book that really took us out of our comfort zone, we move on to one that, for me personally, I don't want to call it my comfort zone, my comfortable place, but it's a book where I felt so at home and felt so seen. It's Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Fearless, gripping, spanning three continents and numerous lives, Americana has been described as a literary masterpiece, and rightly so, and one of the defining books of the decade. It was shortlisted, actually, for the 2014 Women's Prize for Fiction. Following Nigerian high school sweethearts Ifemelu and Obinze as they navigate their lives and relationship across Nigeria, the United States and the United Kingdom, Adichie beautifully explores themes including race, relationships and belonging. What makes Americana such a defining book for you?
You know, I felt like there had to be a Chimamanda in one of my picks, and how well that book has stood up, actually, since 2013, and the power of a female story and a female protagonist that was forthright, that was not easy, that was dealing with challenges of race and ethnicity and what it means in different places in the world. I think a lot of the backdrop was Obama. And I always feel connected to that because Noah was born the day Obama was elected.
2008.
Yeah, so I sort of have this, you know how you're tied to something.
You've totally.
And so that story of that time and actually how different it is to deal with race, ethnicity, and your life as a woman of colour and the transference from Nigeria to the US and then what it meant around huge topics that are still massive recurring themes like immigration and how othering all of that can be. It, to me, of all of her books, and I've read all of them, that was the one that I come back to as still now, because I've reread it in the last month or so, being so relevant and powerful and so broad in its themes, because it is race, but it's also a story of love and relationships and challenges and, you know, in a, on a really, really broad canvas, which is what she writes so beautifully.
Immigration is such a live topic today.
Absolutely.
And I can't actually imagine, because I've not read it for a little while and I felt like we were in such a different place, particularly like you mentioned, 2008, Obama, yes, we can.
Yeah.
To then reread it now, you say just a month ago.
Yeah.
How did that feel? Where did that take you?
I think you would find that the way that immigration is discussed is still absolutely relevant.
Right.
Because it shows that immigration makes people poor, not just in terms of riches, but in terms of the process that they're forced into being so difficult, and sometimes it forcing them into criminal situations. I think that's exactly the context for that which we're evaluating immigration now. I suppose what I find depressing, given the current state of the world, is I don't know that the conversations around race in America are the same as they were in such a sort of optimistic way back in 2008. So some of that sort of geopolitics and the state of the nation. But I think what it means to be black in America was a huge piece of writing that I think she was pretty unique in landing in that way and through a female lens. I suppose it's that. And that it's complex and that the American view of race, in her opinion, can flatten people. And it doesn't allow for different experiences.
Yeah.
And I think the breadth of characters, you know, it's a big book. There's a lot of people in it living their life as black men and women in different ways in different countries. And for me, that was really, really high impact. You know, my own family, Eastern European immigrants to the UK. And I think recognizing that, that doesn't mean one homogenous thing, right?
That sort of notion of sacrifice, the pursuit of belonging is so multifaceted. You actually mentioned in your notes that you first read this in the early years of Love Homeswap.
I did.
So this was a time of constant travel,
totally.
A lot of movement for you. And, you know, you were a single parent to your young children. Balancing that independence, that responsibility, did any part of Ifemelu's self-discovery resonate with your journey?
Yeah, and I think also that her relationships came and went a bit in the novel, didn't they? You know, it's sort of like you think it's a love story, but is it? I think that was really powerful. And I think for me, those years, the early Love Homeswap years, you know, I flew to the US a lot, which meant that I was there and on the ground there and being able to reflect on that. But I think there's a theme for her throughout all of her books about whether relationships can be consistent and how that impacts on a woman's own journey of self-discovery. And I think that's a huge essay question for independent women. Like, what is it that we're trying to figure out? How much of it is our own journey? How much of what we do as you know, heterosexual women is impacted by our relationship with men or not? Or how much should it be? And I think you do age through a lot of those conversations into your 50s. And perhaps this is why this book sits alongside the others that I've picked, where the power of female friendships and relationships almost become the most important thing adjacent to love stories. And our self-discovery is driven by ourselves.
And absolutely, I don't know, I'm sure you've read Dream Count as well, her most recent one. That feels so potent. What is it exactly that we are looking for?
I know.
And those friendships really come through.
there's a theme within all the books that, yeah. that you've picked, which explore women's inner lives in terms of friendship, like we just say, sisterhood, well-being, love, resilience. How do those themes resonate with your own work in the sphere of money and women in health as well?
Yeah. So I have a business that I chair that's reasonably new called The Better Menopause, which is about doctor develop supplements for women in peri and menopause. All of my businesses, I'm a very simple entrepreneur, maybe a simple reader as well, because you're sort of looking for connection. They've reflected different decades of my life. And Better Menopause came about because when I was 48, I got super ill, pneumonia and pleurisy, was really unwell and recovering from being in hospital and trying to figure out why I just didn't feel like myself. And I think that's a sort of common theme for women in their late 40s, and this was 3.5 years ago. So the menopause conversation, actually, it's one of the areas where the UK leads the rest of the world, because we're more advanced and more advanced clinically than the US. And some of that's driven by talent, by the Davina McCall, Mariella Frostruck kind of conversations that have given us a language, particularly for perimenopause, which I'd never heard of. So when I was told post the pneumonia that I was in perimenopause, and the reason that I was feeling so bad, my symptoms were so bad, was because I had no microbiome, because I've been on antibiotics for such a long time. And I always have light bulb moments with anything, and that one was like, hang on a minute, you're telling me that there's an inextricable connection between gut health and women's health, between gut health and perimenopause and menopause. Well, I've never heard of that. And I'm reasonably well informed, because I'm, you know, feel like I take care of my health. And all of the gut health conversations were so male. You know, they were Tim Spector and they were Huberman and they were about longevity. And women don't tend to talk about longevity in quite the same way, probably because we live longer than men.
Yeah, we do.
And so I think that we're increasingly being given a language to focus on our health. And so because I tend to be obsessive when I get a thing into my head, I then went on this massive journey to try and develop the first probiotic for women in midlife that would address these gut health symptoms, because I felt like I've been taking probiotics forever, and what I learned was they just wouldn't touch the sides, because the female microbiome in midlife is totally different to the male microbiome or our microbiome when we're younger. So that was the sort of thesis behind the Better Menopause. We now have 4 doctor-developed supplements, one of which is in clinical trial, and they deal with the big symptoms of menopause. So gut health, which sits over everything, sleep. My sleep's always been terrible, but went totally off the rails in my late 40s. We have Better Night. Metabolism, you know, there's a huge live conversation around GLP-1s, on which I have no judgment, but this is an alternative or to help women on or off board, because one of the big menopause symptoms that we hear most about from our community is midsection, midlife weight gain that they can't do anything about. And then the final product that we launched a few weeks ago is called Better Libido, because Meta doesn't like you talking about sex. Because, you know, again, to slightly arcs back to this wither relationships and the arc of the female life and female reproduction, which is what we hear a lot from women in their 40s and beyond, is they just don't want to have sex anymore. And that has a huge impact on their relationships. So that business and that community and that perimenopause, menopause community, for me, it is part of my motivation to do anything which is make it better. You know, that the stat for me is that 1 in 10 women leave the workforce because of their menopause symptoms. 25% of women want to. I know that our reproductive system tends to count against us in terms of our careers. Like, it's super hard to stay in. What you're doing at the moment, like 4 or 5 months post baby, with the boobs and the pumping, and I mean, I can remember it all. And the point is, it's hard to keep your career on track, to keep being economically productive, to keep your networks going. Like, everything that we know as a driver of success is really hard if you decide to have kids, and if you're having them at the age where, by the way, they are your peak earning years. The mean age to start a business in the UK is 33. That tends to be, not always, but often when women have got young children. So the last thing I want to hear is that they're leaving the workforce in their 50s if they've managed to keep going till then because of their menopause symptoms. So again, I tend to focus and prioritize, where can I use my muscle? Mm. You know, where can I shine a light? And the way that I tend to do it is through building businesses, because I am unashamedly for profit. My work for the prize is charitable work. My work for this is charitable work. But I always lean into, can we just make sure women earn? Because if women earn, then they have agency. And that for me comes from my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, who is a magnificent woman who was extremely glamorous and lived to her late 90s. But she always talked about the need for being economically independent as a woman. And I've seen that in my mother and the women in my family. And I think that just gives you choices. And I feel like if I have a role or a purpose for anything with that work, Better Menopause work or the Investing Women Task Force work or anything that I talk about, it's to help women feel that they can and that they can keep going, whatever that means to them, whether that means working flexibly or working differently, or, you know, God knows I've reinvented myself endlessly because I have quite a short attention span. So I have 5 or 6 years of anything in me and then I want to talk about something different. But I think women can. And if I can convince women that they can, then that's part of how I see my role.
I'm convinced right now.
Good.
Have used your muscles so well. And Debbie's referring to, I was pumping in the studio last week because we had a couple of
Yeah.
We had a couple of recordings and my boobs were full. 3 months postpartum. We've arrived at your fifth and final Bookshelfy Book, Debbie, which is We All Want Impossible Things by Catherine Newman. Eddie and Ash have been best friends for over 40 years. Since childhood, they've seen each other through life's milestones, stealing vodka from their parents, the Madonna phase, REM concerts, unexpected wakes, marriages, infertility, children. So when Eddie is diagnosed with terminal cancer, Ash's world reshapes around the rhythms of Eddie's care, from chipped ice and watermelon cubes to music therapy, from snack smuggling to impromptu excursions into the frozen winter night. Because life is about squeezing the joy out of every moment, about building a powerhouse of memories, about learning when to hold on and when to let go. Tell us about why this is your final
book today. Oh my God,
this
book. I mean, I am not a crier.
I know.
But this book, I can remember, it was also a holiday read for me in Marrakesh, which is another sort of happy place for me alongside Ibiza. This book is just unashamedly about friendship. It's about this huge life-defining friendship between Eddie and Ash, as Ash cares for Eddie, who's dying of ovarian cancer in a hospice. Now, again, I did think about this. It's another one that should be really dark, but it's so moving and it's so humorous and it's so poignant and it's so real. That's what I love about it, because it doesn't canonize the characters. You know, part of the reason that I loved Ash so much is she was dealing with this grief, this unthinkable grief, worse than a relationship loss, by just shagging away around, you know. And so there was sort of humor in the sadness. I know. And it's messy, and Ash's life is messy, and it's full of families, her brothers in it as well, and grief. And this just endless search for connection, which I think drives all of us. I didn't include Nora Ephron, although who doesn't love Nora Ephron? I love Nora Ephron, but it felt quite Nora Ephron-esque in terms of some of the lines. There's some brilliant lines. It's also, which I'm a sucker for, based loosely on a real life story, the story of Catherine Newman and her best friend dying. And it made me absolutely sob my eyes out. I sent it to all of my girlfriends, particularly Joanna, my best mate, who thankfully is not dying of terminal cancer, but who I love. And we just all saw so much in it about how beautiful female friendship is and how it's for life.
Yeah.
You know, and it trumps everything. I suppose that was my sort of takeaway from this book.
I think that's a really profound way of putting it, female friendship. It does. It trumps everything. How have your female friendships evolved over time, and what have they taught you about love and loyalty?
Yeah, I mean, they're my people for sure. I think if I have any skill, I maybe have 2 skills or
you
two
might
and a half.
Have more than
I can read really quickly, so that's like a superpower, particularly for this. I'm good at picking up women along the way. I really am.
Yeah.
And if I look at my circle of female friends, it's a beautiful, varied thing where I've got people who go back to being 4 years old, but I've also got women that I've picked up along the way. You know, I have a very tight-knit group of female entrepreneurial friends because there aren't very many of us, and they have definitely been the people over time who I'm able to be most honest with about work, and that feels very important, but I haven't known them forever. Joanna, who's my sort of closest friend, probably I've famously picked up, you may actually relate to this bit, on the Pilates reformer. So I went back to Pilates. I had a cesarean section with Gracie 6 weeks after she was born. And I mean, my God, I was clinging onto the thing for dear life.
It was quite hard.
Like, I couldn't even move it. And there was a woman next to me who was like a goddess of just sort of... And I said to her afterwards, oh my God, like, I had a baby 6 weeks ago. You know, I've got milk, like, this is all. I'm never, ever going to... And then I'm not hippy-dippy, but I do believe that things can happen for a reason and the universe serves up connection. Or maybe a different way of putting that is, I think that there are moments of serendipity in life. And I went, I think even that night or the night after, to a work event, and she was there with her then partner, who she's not with anymore. And so that was, so I'm good at that. I'm good at kind of, and I think, and Anna, who, you know, is my Albright co-founder and we're involved in Better Menopause together and whom I adore, I was set up with at a party that I nearly didn't go to, of parents at the school of, like, one of those where I'm like, oh, I can't, but it's on the way home, I'll go. And then the dad, who I didn't really know, said, there's someone that you should meet, and that was her. So I think that they are everything. None of that's anti-men. Albright wasn't anti-men. I'm not anti-men in my life. But the power of sisterhood, the power of connection, the power of support, the power of laughs, and the power of what are one of our WhatsApp groups called the commune, which, you know, when all else fails, we focus on how we're all going to live together in old age, etc., etc., has been an amazing thing. And men are wonderful in many ways, and my career would not be where it is were it not for the support of men. But women are the people with whom I can do warts and all supportive conversations through the ups and downs in life. And I think this book, you know, the woman who's dying has a husband, and the woman who's supporting her has a husband, sort of a strange husband, the brothers floating around, anyway, all of that. But it's the story of them. It's the story of them. And that, to me, shows how important knowledge and humour and warts and all, love with the women in your life is.
Eddie's illness reshapes Ash's life.
Yes.
Forces her to slow down. It forces her to pay attention. You've talked previously about how you suffered from burnout in your 40s. And this novel also finds, like you said, joys in small rituals such as food and laughter and shared memories. So I'd love to know how now in your 50s you prioritise your health and what your little rituals are that keep you happy. I mean, you mentioned Pilates.
Yeah. But I mean, I've become a mega weights person, which I never ever was in a million years. I was sort of scared of that. But I find there's a real power in feeling strong. And 40-year-old me didn't really know that. 30-year-old me certainly didn't, because I used to just cardio the life out of everything. So I think there's a power in strength. I definitely, when I'm derailed, which by the way is often, and I know that it can all look a bit glossy and everything, but obviously is not, I see solace in my routine. And my routine is get up early, sweat every day, you know, I like clothes, try and get myself together and be around people that I love, and make sure that in my week I've got time to walk, I've got time to go to the theatre, I've got time to read. Because with my work life, particularly now I have a portfolio, you know, I do Better Men, we did the whole rap sheet at the beginning, board of Channel 4, it's quite easy to lose yourself because you don't, a little bit like for you, Vic, there's an unlimited amount of stuff that you can do.
You could be.
And if you're quite alpha and quite driven and quite hard on yourself, you end up massively overcommitted. And that's always my tendency. I think what I've got better at doing is recognising that just because I can outwork anyone doesn't mean that I should. And actually, there are ways to have more joy. And that's my theme for my 50s, is more joy. Right, more joy, which isn't necessarily the same thing as more work or more success or more nose to the grindstone or bench pressing more. And my nature is that. It's just more joy. And so doing things like going away, I mean, I tend to do like fitnessy, retreaty things with girlfriends and doing that kind of thing and just booking in the time, as well as going on adventures with my kids. I'm about to go to Dublin with my son this afternoon. More joy. And I think a decade ago, I would have found a thousand reasons why I couldn't do that, because I was on the bus and I didn't want anything to derail that, partly because, which I don't think we talk often enough about, there were just economic realities to life that meant that as a single parent, there's stuff that you need to get done. But recognizing that the two are not in opposition to one another, and that you can have a big inner life, you can take yourself out of your life through reading or going to the theatre, you can go on adventures, you can be with your girlfriend, you can laugh, you can still work really hard and do everything that you need to do, but you don't need to say yes to everything. And so a part of more joy in my 50s, but also say no. I never used to say no.
I love that. I'm taking notes, but, you know, a big inner life and more joy feels like a mantra we can all live by. Yeah. Debbie, thank you so much. I'm going to ask you one more question before I let you go, and that is, if you had to pick one book on your list as a favourite, which would it be and why?
I think I would pick Loved and Missed by Susie, because I just think it's a beautiful and important book about the highs and lows of family life and living.
And more joy.
Yeah, more joy.
Debbie, thank you so much. What an absolute joy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
To get to speak to you about books. Thank you.
I'm Vic Hope, and you've been listening to the Women's Prize for Fiction Bookshelfy podcast, brought to you by Baileys and produced by Birdline Media. Thank you for joining me for this episode. You'll find all the books discussed in our show notes. If you've enjoyed it, please leave us a rating or review to help other readers discover even more brilliant books by women. See you next time.